Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, we travel to TMZ, the 30-mile zone, which has become a Hollywood institution and one of the go-to sites for breaking news coverage. At the beginning of TMZ's history, a lot of people viewed it kind of as a gossipy joke, but it since has broken story after story after story and has become a place where a lot of people say if TMZ is reporting it, it must be true. A lot of that is due to the vision and leadership of its founder, Harvey Levin, who you see on TMZ TV and TMZ Live and all the other outlets of TMZ that have been created over the years under Harvey's vision. One of the things he's been working hard on in recent years is the documentary business, something he's especially excited about. And recently, he's put together this documentary called 9/11, The Fifth Plane, where one of Harvey's friends told him about this story that he's wanted to do for years about this plane that may have been full of hijackers. So we've got that for you tonight, or this week. Harvey's story about that, and then Harvey's story of TMZ, a little bit of politics, and a little bit of Harvey talking about the future of journalism. So here is our extended full sit-down, including content that we weren't able to fit into TV because of time. Harvey Levin.
Harvey, thank you for having us here at TMZ. For people that are used to watching TMZ Live, Charles is looking a little different today.
Charles is looking a lot taller today, let me tell you.
Yeah. Let's start with this documentary.
Yeah.
For people that haven't seen it yet, what is sort of the basic premise?
Well, it's on Monday night at 9 o'clock on Fox, and the documentary is called 9/11, The Fifth Plane. And the premise is that there was a flight, a United flight, that was supposed to take off from JFK at 9 o'clock in the morning on 9/11, headed for Los Angeles. It was a 767. And there was a lot that happened on that plane that made flight attendants suspicious. And the plane taxied out and would have taken off because the pilot says that normally there's only one or two planes ahead of him, and he would have been in the air. For some reason that day, there were 11 planes ahead of him. So the World Trade Center got hit when they were at the taxiway, and when the second plane got hit, they closed the airport down. The plane went back to the gate. Everybody evacuated the plane. It was fully empty, locked. 20 minutes later, somebody on the ground saw two people running in the airplane, which seemed impossible because everybody was out. So authorities came and they opened the door, and the hatch that goes from the belly of the plane that opens up into the electronics area and then up into the cabin, that hatch was completely open. And the FBI was alarmed enough to go to the hotel where the flight attendants were, interviewed all of them, actually took them to a lineup to see if they could identify four passengers in particular because of things that happened on the plane. And this has never been mentioned in the 9/11 report. Almost no reporting on this, a little bit, but almost none.
Right.
And something weird was happening on this airplane. And we have interviewed the flight attendants, we've interviewed the pilot, and they all believe that they were targeted as a weapon of mass destruction.
That this was the fifth plane that was maybe going to run into the White House or some other spot. And one thing that was especially interesting was the beverage food cart may have saved one of our American institutions here.
Yeah, the four people in first class, who I had just mentioned, they didn't eat meat. And the purser, the flight attendant in first class, wanted to get them fruit plates because it was going to be an especially long flight. And they only had two fruit plates. And she wanted to get two more so they could eat and be comfortable. They were not having it. And according to the flight attendants who watched this, they were arguing, "We don't want food. All we want to do is take off. We want to go now." And the purser persisted, and the plane didn't leave exactly when it was supposed to. Now, how much longer it took, I can't tell you because there's a little bit of a conflict there, but what everybody agrees on is something was going on this airplane. By the way, what I didn't mention was the chief pilot, who is the chief pilot for all the United pilots at JFK that day, the chief pilot told the pilot of this plane, I have to tell you something. The plane next to you, which was one number off in the tail number, the plane next to you, which was a 767 as well, they found box cutters in first class in the seat pockets. And the pilot says he is now convinced those box cutters were meant for his airplane and that it was just a mistake, and believes that somebody on the ground may have been cooperating to put those box cutters in the flight. And he thinks that it is more than a reasonable possibility that the reason the hatch may have been opened is somebody, because these people running in the plane, they were uniformed. We don't know what uniforms they were, but they seem to be wearing uniforms, that what they may have been doing was trying to remove weapons.
Wow. So obviously it's been over 20 years since 9/11. How have we never heard about this?
Well, I got to tell you, Alex, I did hear about it.
Yeah, and where did you hear about this?
So one of my really close friends in college at UCSB became a flight attendant for United. And she's in the documentary. And gosh, it must have been 3 or 4 years after 9/11, we had dinner. And she told me this story. Mm. And she stopped flying after that. That was it for her. She was so freaked out. And she told me it, but at the time she told me there was nothing I could do with it. I mean, I just didn't have that kind of platform. And I never forgot it, though. So 6 or 7 months ago, I had dinner with her again. And I said, Barb, do you remember that story? And she's like, what do you mean, do I remember the story? She said, it defines me. Hmm. And I said, I now have something I can do with it. And I said, I want to do a documentary on this. And so kind of piece by piece, we put together, you know, the flight crew, got them to talk to us, got the pilot to talk to us, got the United dispatcher to talk to us, and others. And this is an unusually long project for us. It took 6 months.
Did you get any pushback from the federal government when you started asking questions on this? What kind of response did you hear?
Nothing. We filed a Freedom of Information request for the FBI. Never got a response. And as the pilot said,
I don't know why that information can't be released. If they were involved, then I could understand why that information isn't being released.
So we don't know if those people that were in first class that may have very well been terrorists, were they ever arrested? Are they living in New Jersey? Are they in Guantanamo Bay? We don't know.
We have no idea.
So do you have any doubt that that was the fifth plane?
You watched it. Sion, what do you think?
I have no doubt that that was the fifth plane. Or at least there's something really fishy about it.
I lean toward the way you're thinking.
Up next, how margaritas in Mexico inspired TMZ.
We're talking to Harvey Levin of TMZ. We talked about you're now in the documentary business. You also have multiple TV shows here. You've got multiple entities, including a tour bus company. You've got multiple websites.
Don't forget the game show.
And a game show as well. You've built an empire here, starting with the website. Where did the idea for TMZ come from?
A margarita haze. I'm serious.
Really?
Yeah. So I produced a show called Celebrity Justice in the early 2000s. And I loved doing that show. And it was on for 3 seasons, and we just couldn't make a go of it business-wise. We just couldn't get the time slots. So when the person who ended up being my business partner at TMZ was the president of Telepictures at the time, which was our parent company. And he called me into his office one day, and he said, how'd you like to run a website? And I said, I could not be less interested. I said, I am a TV guy. Yeah. And at the time, there were no... I mean, websites were very janky.
Extra. We're not the focus. They were an extra, maybe.
They weren't even an extra for a lot of places. Yeah. I mean, there was no news operation online or anything else. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, I have no interest in it. And then I said, by the way, does this mean you're canceling my show? And he said, yeah. And so I passed on it. And I was going to do something else. And I went to Mexico a couple of months later, and I was drinking a couple of margaritas. And in a margarita haze, I just thought, wait a minute. If you start a news operation online and you don't have a time period the way a television show does, or a publishing cycle the way a newspaper or magazine does, and when you get something right, you can get it up competitively, you can win.
You're ahead of everybody.
And it just seemed like such a simple idea. So I got back to LA and I called Jim up and I said, is that thing still available? And I said, if we can look at this as a news operation, I think I'm in. And so it was literally that simple.
What was the first story where you guys knew, that's huge, we've done something, we made our name?
I mean, the big first story was Mel Gibson on Pacific Coast Highway.
Making anti-Semitic and misogynistic comments.
Yeah. I remember it was a Friday that we got the story. And by the time we knew we had it, it was like just after 8 o'clock at night on a Friday. So if this were a television show, we'd have to wait till Monday, right?
Mm.
Or a magazine or a newspaper. But at 8:21 or whatever it was, we published it. And so, you know, it went everywhere at the time. And it was a big story. And I remember that moment that, you know, I just thought, wow, the force behind it, I thought we just got to be so responsible with this thing. And it was a moment.
Well, and I think about the two biggest celebrity deaths of my lifetime are Michael Jackson and Kobe Bryant. And you broke both of those stories. And I was wondering sort of the backstory behind those stories and what that must have felt like for you to know that information before everybody else knew that information.
It's funny, because in both of those, we knew a fair amount of time before we actually hit the button.
Mm.
And, you know, and then you think, are we missing anything? And you just want to check and you want to know. And, you know, this is not where you rely on one person and make a phone call. You got to make phone call after. We made 100 phone calls on Michael Jackson, probably as many with Kobe as well. With Kobe, we waited an hour and a half at least before publishing it when we knew.
And so for like Michael and Kobe, you make 100 calls. How do you know, okay, I got this?
I'm not going to tell you how and who, but obviously we knew.
Yeah.
And, you know, we made a ton of phone calls on both of those and others on Prince. It was the same thing. I mean, we made call after call after call. And at a point, you feel sad. You know it's true. And then you still go. And then we would not have posted those stories if we weren't positive.
Do you have any stories that you regret or wish you could take back, or even think maybe we pushed too much or was too much in somebody's face?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, that happens over time where, you know, 2023 is different than 2010, say. And, you know, a lot has changed, and I think we've changed. You know, I think if you went back and looked at what we did in 2010 or what anybody else did in 2010, you're going to look at it differently in 2023. So there's nothing specific I can mention, but I do think that in terms of just the way you work, you evolve.
Well, let's talk about some of the biggest changes, because social media obviously has changed the game in a big way, in the way that celebrities communicate, and it seems like the way that you guys do stories as well. You don't see as much of the camera out there on the street, because people post the stuff themselves. That's not as interesting. It's changed this whole operation.
Well, interestingly, the pandemic changed it.
Yeah.
And the pandemic changed it because we used to have 25 cameras out. And one of the criticisms that I used to get was, God, we don't know half the people who are on your show. Because we'd get somebody out and, you know, it could be some, you know, a B-list celebrity, a C-list celebrity that people don't know. And what we decided to do, listen, during the pandemic, there were no cameras out.
Yeah.
So we really needed to pivot on a dime. And we started looking at social media and looking at other ways of doing stories. And what we found was that we were able to kind of elevate who we were covering and what we were covering. And so now that we're fully out of the pandemic, we have less than a third of those cameras out. And I think our shows and I think our website is better for it.
When we come back, Harvey on his old pal Donald Trump, and there's no love lost.
We're talking with Harvey Levin. We usually talk about politics on our show. So I got to ask you at least one question about that.
Shoot.
So you've known Donald Trump for a long time. You did Objectified, your show with him, where we looked at different objects that he had. What do you make of him coming back?
It scares the crap out of me.
Mm. Why is that?
Because when somebody says that I will be your retribution, that is a frightening prospect. Mm-hmm. And it, look, this country, I think, is in deep, deep trouble because of tribalism. And I think there has been tribalism in the media on both sides.
Sure.
I think that there is tribalism in politics, and I think he is the king of tribalism. And, you know, it's that you're either with me or you're my mortal enemy. That's not the way to live. And I think he lives that way. And I think that if he's gonna run, but if you run on a platform of revenge, where do you think that takes this country?
Do you think DeSantis can beat him?
I don't know. I mean, who knows? Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen? I stopped predicting anything after O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
So, you know, who knows what's going to happen? I have no idea.
We saw Joe Biden was here in Southern California this week. I was out with him. What do you make of him running again? Are you concerned about his age?
Well, I think it's an issue.
Yeah.
And it's not even, to me, it's not an issue of whether he seems to have all of his faculties. I mean, he does. I mean, yeah, maybe there are moments he has, but look, the guy is engaged and everything else. But the reality is, how old is he, 80?
81, going 80. On 82.
Okay, so we are now facing the prospect of an 86-year-old president.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know how life works, right? And things happen in life, and the older you get, when you get around that age, the reality is you don't last forever. So, you know, is age a factor? I think age is a factor. I don't think that necessarily means that his faculties have dimmed to a point where you have to be alarmed. I don't think that's so much the issue as just math.
Right. Do you think there's a stronger Democrat?
I don't see it, do you?
Right now, it's sort of, that's the challenging part of this whole thing.
But
for
who?
A lot of Democrats. Because you talk to Democrats and they say, we don't want Biden. We think he's too old.
Right.
And then you ask them, well, then who?
They don't
and
know.
And then they don't know.
They don't know.
Or they debate or they say, not Kamala Harris. And so then they end up back at, okay, I guess it's Biden.
Well, you just said something that's really interesting. Not Kamala Harris. So if people are not really, feel confident with her, you know, if and there are clearly are a lot who don't, what does that do to the calculus? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I'm so curious to see what Biden does. My gut is that she'll stay on the ticket, but I think that's going to become an issue just because of his age.
And black women are some of the most important part of the Democratic base.
Absolutely.
They probably wouldn't like that.
Absolutely.
Up next, Harvey looks back and forward.
Where do you see the future of media going? Obviously, you were ahead of the curve with TMZ all those years ago. Where do you see that going next?
So, for a long time, I've always thought that television and the internet will have had their day sometime in the near future. That we're not going to have television the way we know it, and we're not going to have the internet the way we know it. That if you look at television and internet and really anything else, there are two reasons you go to it. Entertainment and information.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So the way I see it is that, you know, eventually somebody's going to realize that all you're really looking at are the assets from television and the assets from online. And if you can blend those and create a richer experience where you collapse the two into one, It's not television and it's not the internet. I've been talking about this to the staff for about 10 years, which is why we created TMZ Live, which is where we're sitting right now, mm-hmm. because TMZ Live to me tried, we're trying to kind of blend those two things. Mm-hmm. And you know, I call it, my staff just rails on me for this, I call it Intervision. Because, I mean, that's kind of what it is. It's like a combination of the two things. Yeah. And it hasn't been fully developed, but I don't see how that doesn't happen, where you end up just with one big menu and one screen and one remote, and you're watching a program where you can watch television and there's a second screen, maybe with a photo gallery or something pops up, where you try to blend the assets into one. So, you know, my bosses who are in television don't particularly like me talking about this, but I just see the two blending someday soon.
And lastly, how would you define your legacy?
I don't even think, no. I don't care. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, we're doing the best we can. You know, if you try to be fair and accurate and honest, I mean, that's the best you can hope for. Beyond that, no.
Well, Harvey, I think you do some of the best work, obviously, breaking news almost every single day that everybody talks about. You have been nothing but kind to me and a great friend and mentor. And it means a lot for you to have us here and for all of us to learn from you this week on The Issue Is. So thank you so much for doing
this. That is really nice of you saying that, Alex.
No, seriously, thank you for everything. You're the best.
Thanks.
Harvey Levin, thanks for watching The Issue Is. Again, check it out because we can't promote it enough.
We can't.
9/11, The Fifth Plane, 9 o'clock on Fox on Monday night, and you'll see some of Harvey's best work. And you don't even see Harvey at all.
Yeah,
you never see his face. You hear his voice, but you don't see him. But it's really interesting stuff. Harvey Levin, thank you. Thanks to the folks at TMZ. We'll see you next week for more of The Issue Is.
Our thanks to Harvey Levin, and our thanks to you for listening to this special edition of The Issue Is. We'll see you next time for more. In the meantime, we hope you like us, review us, tweet us, share us, talk to your friends about us. All of it is helpful as we try to build out this brand. I'm Alex Michelson. Have a great week.